You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Dear Science, we've got lots of science this week, and our expert, Professor Alan Blackman, is here to share all of that science with us. And we're going hot and, or cold and hot, I guess, this week.
We are. There's a common theme.
Starting on the cold with Big Ice. What is Big Ice up to? What are they trying to sell us?
I love it. Well, first up, I mean, it's 2025. Happy New Year to all the regular listeners out there and the irregular listeners. And, gosh, this must have been going for close on 10 years possibly now, I think.
The Ice.
No, the Dear Science.
Oh, Dear Science. Wow, we're an institution now.
It's at least 8 years anyway, so this might be the 9th or the 10th year. I'm not sure. Anyway, but, Big Ice.
Big Ice.
So how do we know what the climate was like way back in the day is the question, because we're always being told, well, you know, the climate was this and the climate was that and blah-de-blah-de-blah. How do we know? Well, one way of knowing would be to look at something like the rings on trees, for example.
They're very old.
They are. Well, it depends.
It depends on the tree.
It depends what you mean by old. So
yes.
The oldest tree in the world is about 4,000 years old.
And that's pretty old.
We can get climate records back to sort of, you know, that long ago from tree rings. But what about if we want to go further, like, let's say, sort of millions of years?
My guess would be rocks. But
yeah, rocks. Rocks can sort of help as well, but in fact it's ice. Ice. Ice is the good stuff, okay? So we've got people up in the Arctic, we've got people down in the Antarctic, and they are taking ice cores, okay? So they're basically just digging out big rods of ice down there.
They're very impressive to look at. I mean, I saw the images in this article. Mm. It's massive.
How are they getting this much
ice out of the ground?
Well, this is the European Project for Ice Coring in Antarctica, and of course, it's got an acronym. It's EPICA, or EPICA, or something like that. And so this is a bunch of European countries who've got together and gone to one of the most desolate places on planet Earth, and they have managed to, down in Antarctica, pull out a 2.8 kilometre long cylinder of ice. Wow. Okay. Yeah, 2.8 kilometres long. So the place where they did this is, as I say, it's as desolate as all heck, and it's at an elevation of around about 3,200 metres, which it kind of has to be when you think about it, because if that's a 2.8 kilometre plug of ice, then you've got to be at least 2.8 kilometres up, don't you?
That makes sense.
And, you know, thinking that Mount Cook, for example, is 3,764 metres high.
We are pretty high up.
So you are pretty high up, okay? And this is the result of 200 days of work over 4 years. Now, remembering, of course, they can only work in the summertime because it's dark the rest of the time.
Yep.
And their maximum temperature in the summertime is around about minus 35 degrees Celsius. So, you know, this is desolation itself. You've got to be pretty committed if you want to go here and do some science. So what are they doing all of this for? Why are they taking these big cores of ice? Well, what they're doing is looking at gas bubbles that are trapped in the ice, okay? And specifically, they're looking for greenhouse gas, bubbles of greenhouse gases trapped in the ice. And because that ice never has melted down there, then obviously this is going to give us a continuous record.
It's a prime record as well, right?
You know, yeah, yeah. So,
perfectly preserved.
Yep, absolutely perfectly preserved. And so, you know, the longer they can get their cylinder of ice, the further back that they can go. And it works out that roughly each meter of ice contains about 15,000 to 20,000 years of climate information. Yeah, I saw your eyes. I saw your eyes widen.
So we've got a 2.8 kilometer long core of ice.
Yes.
That's so many years.
Yes, yes. So that is 1.2 million years.
And we just have all that now.
And it's there.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So they've done what you would call the hard work, I guess, the manual labor, actually extracting that out. And now what they are going to do is to take it back to labs in Europe and analyze it. And so this is obviously a pretty difficult thing to do, because we don't want any contamination from, you know, yeah, from our modern day circumstances.
You'd probably have to chop it up as well, I'd imagine.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. So what they've done, they've come up with a very clever way of analysing this. So what they want, as I say, are these gas bubbles in the ice, basically. Now, what they don't want is to melt the ice and analyse it, because these gases, your carbon dioxides and your methanes and everything, they're a little bit soluble in water, okay? And so if you actually end up melting the ice while you're analysing it, then part of your sample can get dissolved away in the water, and it gets lost. So what they do is that they sublime the ice.
Okay? How does one sublime ice?
How does one sublime ice? One lowers the pressure. Mm. Okay, so if you lower the pressure of ice, you can get it going not from the solid to the liquid to the gas. It goes straight from the solid to the gas.
Ah.
Okay. So that's sublimation. Okay. Mm. And so if you sublime it, and what they do is they sublime it about 1 centimeter at a time. And they use lasers to do this. They sublime it. All of the water then freezes out, and the gases that they're interested in, they can then put into a temperature about -258, and then that. You end up with the solid gases.
Wow.
So they separate out the water, you've got your gases, and then they can do some fancy sort of laser work and stuff like that, and they can figure out the amounts of all of your greenhouse gases and stuff
like
that.
Very precise process.
And so, you know, the big thing about this is that now this is going to let them go back to 1.2 million years ago and figure out... basically, they have a continuous record of the climate between today and 1.2 million years ago. And at the moment, the best that we can do is about 800,000 years, okay? So they've increased that by, you know, there's 50% better straight away. And they're interested in this because between around about 900,000 and 1.2 million years ago, something weird happened in the Northern Hemisphere, and we don't quite know what it was, okay?
Just
we know
something odd.
Something was happening to the ice crusts in the Northern Hemisphere. And so now that they've managed to extract this, you know... Boy, they're going to be analysing this until the cows come home.
1.2 million years worth of ice analysis.
Big job. Yeah. Okay.
Wow.
But, you know, this, as you say, big ice. I like it.
Yeah, big ice.
Yeah.
And then now we've got some more news on pollution and air quality.
Hmm.
Lead poisoning in Rome.
Yeah. Very interesting. So let's talk the good old Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire.
Classic time.
Well, again, I had to look this up because my history is obviously not as good as I thought it was. I thought the Roman Empire existed quite a few sort of 100 years before the Common Era. I was wrong. 27 BCE, apparently, is when the Roman Empire really started.
That's where they kicked off.
Yeah, apparently. And the period from 27 BCE to 180 CE, about a couple of 100 years, is called Pax Romana. Because it was all good then if you're a Roman. Not so crash odd if you're a slave of a Roman, probably. But there was lots of prosperity. There was lots of peace. Everyone was happy.
Best time to be a Roman.
Indeed. But according to a new paper that's just been published, it was also a time of decreasing IQ for your average Roman.
Why are the Romans getting less intelligent during this period of prosperity?
Well, it's that good old element lead.
Mm.
Now, we know about the Romans and lead. We know the stories about, so the Romans invented plumbing, lead pipes.
Yes.
Okay, so the water came out of lead pipes. So that's where the old name lead, the chemical symbol PB, the Roman, the Latin name is plumbum.
Mm.
Okay,
yes.
So that's where we get plumbing from.
Oh.
And they use, good.
I knew about plumbum. I didn't make the connection to plumbing.
Okay.
I love etymology.
We know that they use lead-based glazes on their pottery and stuff like that. We also know that they used to put lead acetate in their wine to make it taste sweeter. Okay, so they were sort of pushing uphill against lead in that
lead's
case.
Lead's everywhere now.
But there's this new paper that now looks at now the amount of airborne lead around sort of Rome and stuff.
Because they can't get enough of it.
Exactly. and it sort of concludes that this forms a significant amount of their exposure to lead. Mm. And you might think, well, why the heck did they have lead in the air? What was giving lead in the air? Mm. And this was a result of silver smelting. Okay. So silver just sort of happens to be in places where there are lots of lead compounds, particularly a thing called called galena, which is lead sulfide.
Right.
Okay. And so if you're trying to smelt silver in the presence of lead sulfide, basically what they were getting was one for each gram of silver they got, they were putting about 10 kilos of lead into the atmosphere.
And for context, how much lead is a safe? How much lead is certainly the amount
not,
that you want?
Not that amount, anyway. Right. So they were putting a buttload of lead into the air. Mm. And again, it's your good old ice cores that are telling us this. So they've been up in the Arctic getting ice cores from up there. And, you know, they can date these things. You know, they know where, basically what, you know, length of ice corresponds to what particular year. And they found a lot of lead in this period between 27 BCE and 180 CE in the Pax Marana. Lots and lots of lead. And what they also found was that just around about the end of that, around about 165 CE, there was a big plague. Okay, and that killed off about 10% of the population.
Nasty.
And they also found that the silver coins that the Romans used, that's why they're mining the silver coins, the amount of silver in the silver coins got less and less and less around that time as well.
Mm.
Coming to the conclusion that, right, if 10% of your population dies, then you're going to have fewer people to work in the mines.
Right.
Okay. And less silver, you know, sort of corresponds to that as well. So, and so what they found was the maximum in lead was, again, sort of towards the end of the Pax Romana, and then it started dropping off.
When you've got a peaking population sort of thing.
Yeah. Oh. And so what they estimate is around about half a million tons of lead were introduced in the atmosphere around through the Pax Romana, which, you know, is definitely not good. And they figured, sort of using modern day sort of techniques and stuff, that would correspond to around about a 3-point decrease in the IQ of your average Roman were this to be ingested. Okay,
right. So, I mean, 3 points is not that bad.
Well, if you're starting from a low point, it's probably not
that's
great.
True. Yeah, 3 points now is maybe 10 points to the average Roman. Comparatively, if we're looking at a percentage loss.
But you know, that to me is astonishing. The fact that they've put so much into the atmosphere just to get that silver. You know.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is a result of, you know, heating things up to high temperature and everything and volatilizing the lead and, you know, it gets into particulate form and away it goes. And it ends up in the Arctic and it ends up all over the place.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're busy ingesting it and blah, blah, blah.
That's the really shocking one to me. They're not just affecting Romans at that point, right? There'd be people in surrounding regions, even across the other side of the world, who would be ingesting more lead than usual.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So one of the thoughts of why the Roman Empire, or certainly the Western Roman Empire, sort of came to an end in the year 476 CE was as a result of lead. They were sort of thinking, well, you know, people were just drinking all this wine laced with lead, blah, blah, blah.
We're ingesting so much lead.
But what they now are sort of thinking is that maybe these results sort of argue against possibly that, because they found the peak.
Right, they were already doing it.
Yeah, and that had dropped off, or was certainly dropping off at the end of sort of, 180 CE, your Pax Romana, there or thereabouts.
Might have to look for different reasons.
And so they had another sort of 300 years before the absolute fall of the Western Roman Empire anyway. So, you're right. So maybe it wasn't lead. Maybe it was another reason, but you know, we'll leave that to the historians and et cetera, et cetera.
For all you lead fans out there, you can take that one off the list. It's only bad for you. It didn't cause the end of the Roman Empire. And then we've got a secret volcano here. How does a volcano become secret? And how does it become unsecret afterwards?
Two very good questions, Castor. So in the year 1831, apparently something happened.
Many things,
something
I assume.
Happened.
Yeah.
And then as a result of that something happening, there were famines, big famines across Europe, India, and Japan in the years following 1831. And so, again, scientists have figured out that probably what happened in 1831 was a big old volcanic eruption that altered the climate.
Makes sense.
As can happen with these things, you're putting out, you know, squillions of tons of particulates into the upper atmosphere. That's going to absorb the sun's rays. It's going to lead to general cooling, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and, you know, not good things.
Right.
So they figured out, yep, that's what must have happened in 1831. There was a big volcanic explosion. Trouble is, they could never pin it down. Where was this volcanic explosion? What they knew from analysis, again, of ice cores, there's your common theme today, was that they were seeing a lot more sort of ash and stuff like that in the northern hemisphere ice cores than in the southern hemisphere ice cores.
So they could narrow it down a bit.
So they could at least pin it down to somewhere in the northern hemisphere and probably sort of significantly in the northern hemisphere. Now, you know, you think volcanoes, you think Krakatoa, you think the Philippines, you think, you know, around that sort of neck of the woods, the Ring of Fire, all that sort of stuff, but probably not there because it's too low latitude.
Moving to a less well-known volcano.
Right, exactly. So, again, this comes as a result of, as I say, the analysis of ice cores and stuff, and the analysis of materials around sort of known volcanoes. So they're looking to match up these things. So they're looking particular at isotopes of sulfur. Okay, there's lots of sulfur in volcanic explosions. You know, you go to Rotorua, you smell H2S.
Yeah, it's not great.
No, it's
sorry
not
to
great.
All those that are residents.
So they're analysing that. They're analysing ash, and they're analysing these shards of volcanic glass that get sort of put into the atmosphere when you get these big explosions. And what they have now found, again, in a paper that's just been published last week, so they say the explosion happened at a volcano called Zavaretsky.
I'm going to guess that's in Russia.
Yes, it is now.
It is now, right.
It wasn't. Okay. So Zavaretsky is on Simushir Island, and that is part of the Kuril Islands.
Right.
Now, anybody who knows their World War II will note that in the very, very, very final days of World War II, Stalin decided to declare war on Japan. Basically, I think it was it after the first atomic bomb was dropped, but before the second, something like that. He was just in there for the spoils of war, sort of thing. And so these islands, these Kuril Islands, they're sort of northeast of Japan, and they were Japanese owned. And then, so Stalin went and invaded those. So it is now in
it's now Russian territory,
part of Russia. Right. Okay. And so now these islands are uninhabited.
Right.
And so that's going to make a big difference.
It would have made the invasion pretty easy.
But in terms of knowing about a big explosion, because we're talking, you know, we're talking a massive volcanic eruption. How come there was no written record of it?
Do we suppose they were always uninhabited, or maybe there were people there before 1831?
No, I think what they're saying is that, yeah, they're pretty much always been uninhabited, which is why there's no written record of this actually happening, which is why they have to go to all of this scientific endeavour to go and figure out where this particular eruption actually occurred. And now they've pinned it down to this particular place pretty unequivocally on the basis of all of their chemical analysis of these ice cores. So I think your take-home message for Dear Science today is that ice is bloody useful stuff.
Yeah, ice is nice if you want to know more about science, history, and air quality.
Fascinating stuff. Absolutely amazing.
All right, well, thank you for sharing the wonders of ice with us this week on Dear Science. We'll be back with Dear Science next week as we're back into the new year. Thank you for coming in, as always, Alan. Thank you, Motet, and thank you, Science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the beat.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.